readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Okay, let's admit it. As a nation, we Americans seem to be obsessed with celebrities. While happily, most of us don't give a kick about the Kardashians, we love to know who is dating whom and what wheels the Hollywood bad boys are driving. Guilty pleasures, which might be exactly what the doctor ordered at this frenetic time of year. As your literary guide, I'm ramping it up a notch. Today, we'll spotlight hot new biographies. And the bonus, they're all read by the authors. Fascinating life stories in their own words and in their own voices. So let's get started as we turn to page one of the book report. Amy Poehler's Yes, Please is a laugh-out-loud collection of stories, ideas, lists, and haikus from the mind of one of our most beloved entertainers. The book offers Amy's thoughts on everything from her too-safe Boston childhood to her early days in New York City, to ideas about Hollywood and the biz, and to her joy at being told she had a face for wigs. The audio edition is star-studded with vocal appearances from Carol Burnett, Seth Meyers, Patrick Stewart, Kathleen Turner, even Amy's parents.
The truth is, writing is hard and boring and occasionally great, but usually not. Even I have lied about writing. I've told people that writing this book has been like brushing away dirt from a fossil. What a load of It's been like hacking away at a freezer with a screwdriver. I wrote this book after my kids went to sleep. I wrote this book on subways and on airplanes and in between setups while I shot a television show. I wrote this book from scribbled thoughts I kept in the Notes app on my iPhone, and conversations I had with myself in my own head before I went to sleep. I wrote it ugly and in pieces. I tried hard not to be overly dramatic, like when I wrote this poem in social studies when I was 14. When life attacks you from every side, it hurts too much. And the most painless, easiest way out is death. To survive. Even now, I'm attempting to write this preface in the dark while my oldest boy, Archie, sleeps next to me. He's dreaming and talking, and I'm turning down the light on the screen as I write about how hard it is to write. Writing a book is awful. It's lonely, even with Archie beside me and my editors nagging me. During this process, I have written my editor's emails with subject headings such as, "How dare you?" and "This is never going to work," and "Why are you trying to kill me?" Most authors liken the struggle of writing to something mighty and macho, like wrestling a bear. Writing a book is nothing like that. It's a small, slow crawl to the finish line. Honestly, I have moments when I don't even care if anyone reads this book. I just want to finish it. If you are listening to this, it means that I have finished. More likely, it means my editors have told me I can't keep tinkering anymore. I will take this time now to thank you for listening to this and buying it and eventually turning it into a feature film with Kate Winslet, Katy Perry, Katie Couric as the star. Let me offer this apology. Please excuse the self-indulgent preface. I know what I'm doing. I'm presenting a series of excuses as to why you should lower your expectations so that you can be blown away by my sneaky insights about life and work. I'm a grown woman. I know my own tricks. I know how good I am at bemoaning my process and pretending I don't care so that my final product will seem, you know, totally natural and part of my essence and not something I sweated for months and years. One of the things I've learned about me while writing about me is that I'm really onto myself. I have got Amy Poehler's number, I'll tell you. I've also learned that writing topless tends to relax me. Go figure, life's a mystery. While writing this book, I made many mistakes. I kept a copy of Nora Ephron's Heartburn next to me as a reminder of how to be funny and truthful, and all I ended up doing was ignoring my writing and just rereading Heartburn. I also kept a copy of Patti Smith's Just Kids nearby, which was awful, because her writing is beautiful and poetic, and how dare she? I also read and reread wonderful books by wonderful women. Rachel Dratch's Girl Walks Into a Bar, Sarah Silverman's Bedwetter, Mindy Kaling's Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me, Lena Dunham's Not That Kind of Girl, Catlin Moran's How to Be a Woman, and Tina Fey's Bossy Pants. All are superb and infuriating. My dear friend and Parks and Recreation castmate Nick Offerman had the nerve to start and publish his book, Paddle Your Own Canoe, in less time than it took me to write this preface. I congratulated him when he presented it to me, and then I immediately threw it in the garbage. I made other terrible mistakes while I tried to write this book. I asked people who had already finished books for advice, which is akin to asking a mother with a 4-year-old what childbirth is like. All the edges have been rounded, and they've forgotten the pain. Their books are finished and in their libraries, so all they end up talking about is how you need to stick to your guns and not let the editors push you around, and that your title is important. Stick to my guns. I'm hiding from my editors because I feel so guilty that I haven't worked hard enough and given them something genius or interesting or new. My title is important? Well, then I'm screwed. Because right now I'm vacillating between The Secret 2 and Mosquitoes Love Me, A Woman's Guide to Getting Her Funk On. The only people I can stand to read right now are Pema Chodron, who reminds me that life is messy and everything is a dream, and Stephen King and Anne Lamott, who are two of my favorite writers on writing.
We've just heard Yes, Please by Amy Poehler. If you're a Neil Patrick Harris fan, listening to his new Choose Your Own autobiography is like attending a one-man show on Broadway. Neil, who performs the book, offers up a celebrity memoir with behind-the-scenes looks at the world of entertainment, as well as glimpses into his personal world. NPH dishes about his evolving career, TV, stage, and film, even mentioning his recent turn in Gone Girl. He shares his coming out story, how he met his husband, and how they became parents. You'll learn about his love of magic, Disney, his epic 40th birthday scavenger hunt, and lavish vacations with Elton John.
Annie is great. The best little whorehouse in Texas is great. But it's Les Miserables that first opens up your adolescent soul to the glorious alternate universe that is theater. You become acquainted with the show at the age of 13, when a friend from camp plays a cassette tape of the London cast recording. Cassette tapes, of course, being the cool way to buy and record music that will never go out of style. On initial hearing, it doesn't sound like much more than nonsense, gibberish insanity. An opera, in other words. It's your friend's explanation of the theatrics of it all. Here's where the barricades go up. Here's where so-and-so kisses so-and-so. Here's where this detective dude commits suicide that you find really interesting. You can picture it unfolding in your mind. And if you do say so yourself, your mental stagecraft is awesome. You buy the cast album and play it an infinite number of times. Soon you're forcing your poor mother to listen to Fantine's dying song, but only after providing her with enough schmaltzy context to make sure she's crying by the end. Les Mis enters your psychic landscape, permanently solidifying its place early on in your career when you lose an audition to an actor named Braden Danner, whose principal credit is as Gavroche in the original Broadway production. Oh, no wonder he got the part, you think. I'm just some small-town rube from the mountain time zone, and he's done friggin' Gavroche on Broadway, and man, if I could just be in that show. A year later, you get your first big, miserable break when you and your family visit New York for the first time. You see a great deal of the city and discover the reports are true. It is, indeed, a hell of a town. But more important, you get to take in some Broadway shows. And even importantlier, you get to see Les Mis. And wow. Wow, wow, wow. It is a phenomenal, transcendent experience. You are used to the ruidoso style of stagecraft, the kind where theaters have fold-out metal chairs and basketball hoops hanging from the ceiling. So to watch a show in which an actual, workable, mid-19th century style barricade appears in the middle of everything just blows your mind and drops your jaw. Literally. When the lights come on at the end of Act 1, whose climax, One Day More, features a giant French flag waving and the full cast singing in glorious harmony, creating a heavenly wall of sound, you actually have to make a conscious effort to shut your mouth. You are utterly overwhelmed. Even your brother is impressed. He had felt that the $70 per ticket would, in his case, have been better spent on a sweater. But afterward, he reluctantly admits that was better than a sweater. Which is not only a noble admission, but an internally rhyming one. Your love for theater never subsides. After Doogie Howser takes off, you have the financial means to go to New York during shooting breaks, so you take week-long trips and see up to a dozen shows, two a day whenever possible. The experience remains enthralling, but now that you're a working thespian, it's also educational. By watching carefully, you can gain valuable insights about your craft. That actor's speaking too slowly. That actress is mugging too much. That guy is drunk and possibly high on coke. Instructive stuff. You're particularly drawn to musicals with big giant sets and visual wizardry. City of Angels, for example. That's a show that goes from color to black and white before your eyes. You sit in the audience and marvel, where did the set just go? How did the lights do that? How did they move backward? How did everything go from color to black and white in two sets? Wait, now it's back in color. Then you go backstage and get a tour. And this to you is truly the coolest thing in the world. You're shown the set and the lights and the costumes and learn another variation on the same basic lesson about showbiz you will learn over and over again. It's all, fundamentally, just a bunch of crap glued together and spray painted over. But the wonderful paradox is that knowing this does not detract from the experience of watching it a second time. On the contrary, it makes it that much more miraculous.
We've just heard Choose Your Own Autobiography by Neil Patrick Harris. Margot Howard began her career as a feature writer for the Chicago Tribune. Next, she became a syndicated columnist based at the Chicago Daily News. After writing for diverse publications, she embraced the family business and started Dear Prudence, an advice column for Slate. I say family business because Margot is the only child of the late advice columnist Ann Landers and the niece of her mother's twin sister, Abigail Van Buren, a.k.a. Dear Abby. Today we'll speak with Margot about her very personal memoir, Eat, Drink, and Remarry. The subtitle of the book says it all, Confessions of a Serial Wife. The book is Margot's humorous take on her journey through life and her experiences being married to four different men. Welcome, Margot, and thanks so much for joining us on the Book Report.
I'm happy to be here.
I love the way you begin the prologue of the book. It was clearly my destiny, never a bridesmaid, always a bride. What led you to write the book?
Well, I'm really a newspaper person, but this is my third book. And I realized that what I am inclined to do when I write a book is in the memoir genre. And I thought that this had interest because it's a look inside a life that is not, shall we say, a normal, regular life. I've had an interesting, privileged life in terms of people and what's gone on.
When you married for the first time, your family and friends were very much against your decision and tried to talk you out of it.
Yes.
Does anyone ever listen to advice?
I think maybe young people are inclined not to, but I think a different personality might have listened. I was somewhat willful. I was an only child. Everything had gone my way, and I think subconsciously I thought, well, if this doesn't work, I'll just get another chance.
I know your mother was a strong advocate of MYOB, mind your own business. But knowing what you know now, and after four of your own marriages, would you try to talk someone out of a union you believe will end badly?
If someone asked, if a good friend said, do you think I should marry Sam? and I really didn't, I would say, I'm not sure it's the thing you should be doing, but I would only say it once. And I do that with my children. If I have a strong feeling, and of course they're all quite elderly now themselves, if I have a strong feeling about something that they're doing or about to do, I will say what I think once, maybe twice, but that's it.
Your first attempt at writing was as a Playboy bunny. Can you fill us in?
Well, that was interesting. Being in Chicago and knowing the Playboy brass, I went to Arnie Morton, who was head of food and beverage. I said, look, Gloria Steinem has already snuck in and killed you. What more can happen? Well, if you read the book, you know what can happen, but that's like a surprise in the book. So I was a bunny for 3 days. I was a camera bunny because they were afraid to let me hold a tray with drinks, lest I kill a customer.
Mm.
And it was, I think, a 3,000-word piece, as I recall. I wouldn't swear. And I had a meeting in New York with the head of a big publishing house, courtesy of a friend, and he said, I like the idea. He said, but we'd have to see the writing. And so when I finished that chapter, and you know how that particular chapter ended.
Yes.
I put it in a drawer. I thought, I'm going to undo from him. I'm not going to pursue a book about 10 glamorous jobs for women. And that was what I was able to show the editor when Jean Siskel got me an appointment.
So actually share the story of how you got into newspapers.
Well, I had known Jean Siskel since he was 9, and I was about 16, I think. The age is maybe off by a year or so, because he was the cousin of a chap that I was going out with, so I knew the whole family because I was over there. And then, almost at the minute of my separation from the starter husband, I was invited to a wedding in that family, and the mother was very gracious and very savvy. And she knew that I was newly separated, so she wanted me to have an escort that wouldn't be confused with a date. So it was Jeannie, who was, I wouldn't say all grown up, but he was old enough. He was in his early 20s. He was then the movie critic for the Chicago Tribune. And he was a pet of this very difficult feature editor. And I probably chewed his ear off the whole night, because at the end he said, I don't know if you write. I said, I don't know either. He said, if I have my editor call you, would you come talk? I said, sure. And so I was the newspaper version of Lana Turner on the soda fountain stool.
Can you share a little bit about husbands 1, 2, 3, and 4?
Well, I probably could encapsulate what was going on. The first husband was just nuts. It was like an aberration. He was a very difficult person. And I belted out 3 kids in 5 years with him, and life was so difficult. I was not the world's best mother, but I could afford to have help. So the early years were not my best relative to the children. And with alcohol and his other deficiencies, I thought, okay, I'm getting out of this. So after 7 years, I told him that the jig was up, and to stop me for another 2 years, which he did, he checked into a very pricey psychiatric clinic. He went to the Menninger Clinic for a year and a half. I mean, that doesn't even sound like real, but it was real.
Oh.
So then I dated a string of really lovely, interesting men, had a terrific time, but I think there was some guilt hanging around about the lack in my children's life. So I went looking, actually, I guess you could call it a designer husband. I wanted a guy who could be a father figure, who was not social climbing, interested in money. I wanted a regular guy, and I thought I found one, but kids didn't like him, he didn't like them, and I sort of did this on my own, and that was my bad. I should have had him around the family much more than I did, but he sort of met the checklist, and that was door-to-door less than 4 years. Sorry, fewer than 4 years.
Uh-huh.
And my newspaper business, my newspaper column at that time had really taken off. I was syndicated, and I was offered an interview with the actor who was touring with the national company of Equus. And the publicist told me he was a young Broadway star. He won a Tony in his early 20s. I'd never heard of him. His name was Ken Howard. And I interviewed him, and it was a very long lunch interview. And then he wanted to see me after the performance. And then he, the next night, wanted to see me again. And we just kept going. And then when Eck was closed, it's very hard to keep a play in Chicago 6 months, but he did. We went to California. And that was a long marriage for me then. We were married 14 years, 10 of which were really wonderful. It was a great marriage that somehow got into deep water. He was drinking more than I was comfortable with, but he didn't think he had a problem. So we dithered and tried to figure things out, but finally, after the 13th year, I said, I gotta go. And I wound up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he had spent a year at Harvard's American Repertory Theater when he was hiding from Dynasty and the Colbys. And it was wonderful here, and we bought an apartment. I mean, it was the antithesis to L.A., you can imagine, Cambridge. And so when we unwound, I came back here because we had bought the apartment. And then I was introduced to Dr. Perfect.
What were the elements of your parents' marriage that made it so successful?
Well, that's interesting. They divorced after 36 years.
Hmm.
And my mother said that 35 of those years were really terrific. And the key may have been that they both traveled. They were not together all the time. And they each had careers that interested them enormously. And they were both devoted to me, and they loved each other's company. And when it blew apart, when Mother finally said, I think this is over, that was because Father had fallen in love with a younger woman in England, where they had a house, and my father's business was international, so he was all over the place.
What advice would you give to a young bride?
Boy, If I could talk to my younger self, I would say, I would jump ahead all those years, but put that thinking into play and say, look for character, look for qualities, stop and think, what do I want in a marriage, in a husband, in a partner? Just stop and think, or as my mother would say, just stop. You would think it's hard to be funny writing about three divorces and four marriages, but it is very funny because I have always looked at things through the lens of laughter. As my wonderful mother used to say, sometimes if you don't laugh, you'd cry.
That's right. Well, I want to share with the readers that it was a wonderfully entertaining book. It was like a conversation with you. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for letting me come.
All righty. Goodbye.
Bye.
Actor Alan Cumming grew up in the grip of a man who held his family hostage, who meted out violence with frightening ease, who waged a silent war with himself that spilled over onto everyone around him. That man was Alex Cumming, Alan's father. Alan's memoir, Not My Father's Son, is being hailed as an honest, inspirational story. When TV producers approached Alan to appear on a popular celebrity genealogy show in 2010, he enthusiastically agreed. He hoped to solve a family mystery. His maternal grandfather, Tommy Darling, had disappeared into the Far East after World War II. Alan's mother knew little about him. He'd been a courier, carrying information between battalions on his motorbike. The last time she had seen her father, Alan's mother was 8 years old. When she was 13, the family was informed he died by his own hand, an accidental shooting. But this was not the only mystery laid before Alan's feet. His father, whom Alan had not seen or spoken to for more than a decade, reconnected just before the filming of the show. He had a secret he had to share, one that would shock his son and change Alan's life forever.
With humor and insight, Alan, who performs the book, moves back and forth in time, integrating stories from his Scottish childhood and his current stage, TV, and screen experiences. This is a story of embracing the best aspects of the past and triumphantly pushing the darkness aside.
But Tom had a job now. He left every morning in a shirt and tie, and our father hated him for it. Tom was no longer in his thrall. Tom had escaped. I hadn't been so lucky yet. My mother tried to intervene. "I'll take him to the barber's on Saturday morning, Ali," she said. "He'll be working on Saturday. He's not getting away with slouching off his work again. There's too much of that going on in this house. Do you hear me?" "Yes," I managed. But now I knew it was a lost cause. It wasn't just a haircut. It was now my physical shortcomings as a labourer, my inability to perform the tasks he gave me every weekend and many evenings, tasks I was unable to perform because I was 12, but mostly because he wanted me to fail at them so he could hit me. You see, I understood my father. I had learned from a very young age to interpret the tone of every word he uttered, his body language, the energy he brought into a room. It has not been pleasant as an adult to realize that dealing with my father's violence was the beginning of my studies of acting. "I can get one tomorrow at school lunchtime." My voice trailed off in that way I knew sounded too pleading, too weak, but I couldn't help it. "Yes, do that, pet," my mum said kindly. I could sense the optimism in her tone, and I loved her for it. But I knew it was false optimism, denial. This was going to end badly, and there was no way to prevent it. Every night, getting off the school bus, walking through the gates of the estate where we lived, past the sawmill yard where my father reigned, and towards our house, was like a lottery. Would he be home yet? What mood would he be in? As soon as I entered the house and changed out of my school uniform and began my chores, bringing wood and coal in for the fire, starting the fire, setting the table, warming the plates, putting the potatoes on to boil, I felt a bit safer. You see, by then I was on his territory, under his command. I worked for him, and that seemed to calm my father, as though my utter servitude was necessary to his well-being. I still wasn't completely safe, of course. I was never safe. But those chores were so ingrained in me, and I felt I did them well enough that even if he did inspect them, I would pass muster, so I could breathe a little easier until we sat down to eat. My father was the head forester of Panmure Estate, a country estate near Carnoustie on the east coast of Scotland. The estate was vast, with 50 farms and thousands of acres of woodland covering over 21 square miles of land. We lived on what was known as the estate premises, the grounds of Panmure House, though by the time we lived there, the big house was long gone. In 1955, as one of many such austerity measures forced upon the landed aristocracy, its treasures were dismantled and then explosives razed it to the ground. All that remained were the stables, where on chilly Saturday mornings during hunting season, I'd report, banging my wellies together to keep the feeling in my toes, to work as a beater, hitting trees with a stick in a line of other country boys, scaring the birds up into the air so that drunk rich men could shoot at them. Attached still to the stables was the building that had been the house's chapel. Now it was used for the annual estate Christmas party and occasional dances or card game evenings for the workers. We lived in Nursery House, so-called because it looked out on a tree nursery, where seedlings were hatched and nurtured to replace the trees that were constantly felled and sent back to the sawmill that lay up the yard behind us. My father was in charge of the whole process, from the seeds all the way to the cut lumber and everything in between, as well as the general upkeep of the grounds. It was all very feudal and a bit Downton Abbey, minus the Abbey, and 50 years later. I answered the door to men who referred to my father as the Maester. There were gamekeepers and big gates and sweeping drives and follies, but no lord of the manor, as during the time we lived there, the place was owned by, respectively, a family shipping company, a racehorse owner's charitable trust, and then a huge insurance company. I didn't know it at the time, but I was living through the end of an era of grand Scottish estates, as now, like Panmure, they'd been mostly all dismantled and sold off. Looking back on it, it was a beautiful place to grow up. But at the time, all I wanted was to get as far away as possible. I had seen my father's van parked by the tractor shed as I walked by, so he was home.
That was Not My Father's Son by Alan Cumming. In I Must Say, My Life as a Humble Comedy Legend, Martin Short tells the tale of how a showbiz-obsessed kid from Canada transformed himself into one of Hollywood's favorite funny men. Short, who narrates, takes you on a hilarious and occasionally heartbreaking ride through his life and times. From early years in Toronto as a member of the fabled improv troupe Second City to the all-American comic big time of Saturday Night Live. He shares his memorable roles in movies such as Three Amigos and Father of the Bride. Throughout, he freely shares the spotlight with friends, colleagues, and collaborators, including Steve Martin, Tom Hanks, Gilda Radner, Mel Brooks, Nora Ephron, and David Letterman. But there's another side to Short's life that he has long kept private. He lost his elder brother and both of his parents by the time he turned 20. And more recently, he lost his wife of 30 years to cancer. In I Must Say, Short talks about the pain these losses inflicted and the upbeat life philosophy that has carried him through.
The man is an idiot. Nevertheless, after questioning both candidates, the interviewer declares, "Your credentials are so darn equal and I don't know how to decide. I can't make up my mind." The male candidate proposes that the matter be settled by arm wrestling. The interviewer agrees. Then the man pins down the woman's arm, thereby winning the job. Scene. Peter Aykroyd, Danny's little brother and a gifted comic performer in his own right, played the interviewer. Catherine O'Hara was the female candidate. John Candy had played my part, the male candidate, in a brilliantly John way, as a bashful, nervous, sweet-faced soul who was heartbreakingly aware of how out of his depth he was. In other words, as a guy who could be in that situation in real life. I knew I couldn't replicate that. Only a fool would try to replicate anything that John did, so I decided to go in a broader, more pop art direction. First, my character would talk funny. I took his unusual timbre from my sister Nora's husband, Ralph, who spoke in a kind of resigned, sleepy voice. Then I added a Canadian tick that's not unlike Valley Girl upspeak, wherein even declarative sentences end like questions. In high school, I had a geeky friend named Patrick who talked this way. He was an amateur photographer. I'd ask him, "Patrick, what'd you do this weekend?" He'd say, "I took a lot of slides." I'd respond, "Really? Did you develop them?" And he'd say, "No, I didn't feel I had to develop them, because, like, I took them, so I know what they are in my mind." You could almost chart out the notes of his speech musically on staff paper. I couldn't help but make a mental note of Patrick's speech patterns. I thought, I must remember this, for someday I just might make millions off it. For the character's wardrobe, I unearthed an old shirt from my teen years with a dated rust-and-gray checked pattern. I buttoned it up to my neck and hitched up my trousers high above my navel. Ed, as I decided to call my underqualified idiot job candidate, was complete. Well, maybe not quite. I decided to apply some grease to the front of my hair so it stuck up a little to make Ed's physical appearance more awkward still. The audience, thank God, seemed to like Ed from the outset. Catherine, as prim job applicant Barbara O'Leary, confidently rattled off to the interviewer all the degrees that she held. A Bachelor of Mathematics from McGill, a Master's in Business Administration from Columbia, and so on. As she did so, Ed, in full view of the audience, would register increasing panic, his smile turning into a grimace, his breasts deepening, his eyes cast downward, his whole body palpitating. This silent meltdown always got a big laugh, the biggest in the sketch, which was an utter revelation to me. Part of my trepidation about improvisational comedy was that I thought I would have to come up with funny lines all the time, on the spot. What I discovered, through Ed, was that I simply needed to commit, to not worry about jokes. The reaction seemed to get the biggest laughs, not the action. I didn't need to be a stand-up comedian delivering punchlines. If I just sincerely devoted myself to Ed's panic with every fiber of my being, the audience would commit to him.
The deeper I got into my first season with Second City, the more confident I became about pushing Ed further. One day, backstage, Peter Aykroyd remarked, "Boy, Marty, that hair is standing taller every time you do that scene." He was right. I was putting more and more grease into it. So to make Peter laugh, I pushed my forelock straight up into a point, like a unicorn's horn, and left it that way. When we did Sexes that night, my entrance drew its biggest laugh yet. Well, I thought, isn't that what we're trying to achieve here? Thus, forevermore, did Ed have pointy hair. 4 years earlier, when Second City first set up shop in Toronto, I couldn't bring myself to audition. I was afraid to. The improvisational troupe and theater had been a going concern in Chicago since 1959, and its decision to open a branch in Canada was like an answered prayer to most of my friends. Many of them were castmates from the musical Godspell, whose Toronto production, mounted in 1972, included such then-unknowns as Eugene Levy, Andrea Martin, Dave Thomas, Victor Garber, Gilda Radner, and me. For all of us, along with the show's musical director, Paul Schaefer, Godspell was our big break, our first serious professional job in show business.
That was I Must Say by Martin Short. The creator of iconic TV programs, including All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, and Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman, Norman Lear remade our TV culture while leading a life of unparalleled political, civic, and social involvement. Sharing the wealth of Lear's 90 years, even this I get to experience, performed by Lear, is a memoir to a remarkable life. In the 70s, Lear's comedies were viewed by 120 million people per week. His shows dealt with the most serious issues of the time and still left audiences howling. Lear feels he's led a charmed life. He flew some 50 bombing missions over Germany with the 15th Air Force. In post-World War II, in Hollywood's golden years, he befriended the likes of Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, wrote and directed Frank Sinatra, Robert Redford, and Dick Van Dyke, worked for Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin, and became the highest-paid comic writer in the country. Shamelessly in love with his country, Lear founded People for the American Way, an organization to protect civil rights. He bought an original copy of the Declaration of Independence, printed the night of July 4, 1776. He sent it traveling across the country to schools, libraries, and public institutions to be shared with citizens everywhere.
At one point, someone I didn't know but instantly disliked offered to buy my father's red leather chair. The throne, from which he had controlled the radio dial on our floor model Atwater Kent, just as 40 years later, Archie would control the Bunker family's TV viewing from his living room armchair. As my mother and the scavenger agreed on a price, I was devastated. The loss of my father's chair was like losing him twice in the same week. And as if that were not bad enough, I would soon learn that my mother planned to take my younger sister to live with her and leave me with various relatives until my father got out of jail and the family could be reunited. I clutched all that remained of my summer dream, that unused roll of Norman M. Lear cloth, a piece of silent sadness, which I managed to keep with me well into my 30s, perhaps even my 40s, and my eyelids bit down hard on the tears I was fighting to hold back. At that point, someone, an uncle or cousin or neighbor, placed his hands on my shoulders, looked deep into my eyes, and announced with that soapy solemnity that so many adults use when they are offering gratuitous counsel to the young, "Remember, Norman, you're the man of the house now." This had to be the moment when my awareness of the foolishness of the human condition was born. I was just past my 9th birthday. My father had been brought down before my eyes from a 10 to a 0. My mother and sister were about to disappear from my daily life. My own identity was no more than a thin bit of fabric in my fist. and I was looking up into the face of this fatuous, telling me that I was the man of the house now. And then he added, with a smarmy smile I wanted to rip from his face, "No, no, son, a man of the house doesn't cry." How could I not have developed a deep appreciation for the absurdities amid the gravity of our existence? In my 90-plus years, I've lived a multitude of lives. There was that early life with my parents and relatives, a life as a kid with my blood buddies Herbie Lerner and the Schwartz twins, a life in high school zeroing in on the humor in our existence, a life in college cut short by World War II, a life as a crew member in a B-17 bomber flying 52 missions over Europe, a life in the world of entertainment, with sublives in television, radio, movies, and music, a life as a political activist, a life in philanthropy, a late starting life as a spiritual seeker, three lives as a husband, six as a father, with my youngest born 48 years after my eldest, and four as a grandfather. In the course of all these lives, I had a front row seat at the birth of television, wrote, produced, created, or developed more than 100 shows, had 9 on the air at the same time, finished one season with 3 of the top 4 and another with 5 of the top 9, hosted Saturday Night Live, wrote, directed, produced, executive produced, or financed more than a dozen major films. Before normalization, led an entourage of Hollywood writers and producers on a 3-week tour of China, founded several cause-oriented national organizations, including the 300,000-member liberal advocacy group, People for the American Way, was told by the New York Times that I changed the face of television, was labeled the number one enemy of the American family by Jerry Falwell, was warned by Pat Robertson that my arms were too short to box with God, made it onto Richard Nixon's enemies list, was presented with the National Medal of the Arts by President Clinton, purchased an original copy of the Declaration of Independence, and toured it for 10 years in all 50 states.
We've just heard "Even This I Get to Experience" by Norman Lear. Fashion designer, philanthropist, wife, mother, and grandmother, Diane von Furstenberg shares her life in The Woman I Wanted to Be. Diane, who performs the book, started out with a suitcase full of jersey dresses and an idea of who she wanted to be. In her words, quote, "the kind of woman who is independent and who doesn't rely on a man to pay her bills." She has since become that woman and so much more, establishing herself as a global brand and a major force in the fashion industry, all the while raising a family and maintaining that her children were her greatest creation. Von Furstenberg reflects on an extraordinary life, from childhood in Brussels to her days as a young jet-set princess to creating the dress that came to symbolize independence and power for an entire generation of women. She opens up about her family and career, overcoming cancer, and devoting herself to empowering other women.
There's a large frame on the bookshelf in my bedroom in New York. In it is a page torn from a German magazine of 1952. It is a photo of an elegant woman and her small daughter in the train station of Basel, Switzerland, waiting for the Orient Express. The little girl is nestled in her mother's tented coat and is eating a brioche. That was the first time, at the age of 5, that I had my photo in a magazine. It is a sweet picture. My mother's older sister, Juliette, gave it to me when I was first married, but it is only recently that I realized its true importance. On the surface, it is a photograph of a glamorous, apparently wealthy woman en route to a ski holiday with her curly-haired little girl. The woman is not looking into the camera, but there's a hint of a smile as she knows she's being photographed. Her appearance is elegant. Nothing would indicate that only a few years before she was in another German-speaking railroad station, coming back from the Nazi concentration camps, where she had been a prisoner for 13 months, a bunch of bones, close to death from starvation and exhaustion. How did she feel when the photographer asked her name to be put in the magazine? Proud, I imagine, to be noticed for her style and elegance. Only 7 years had passed. She was not a number anymore. She had a name, warm, beautiful, clean clothes. And most of all, she had a daughter, a healthy little girl. God has saved my life so that I can give you life, she used to write me every New Year on my birthday. By giving you life, you gave me my life back. You are my torch, my flag of freedom. My voice catches each time I speak publicly about my mother, and I do in every speech I make, aware that I wouldn't be giving that speech if Lili Namias had not been my mother. Sometimes it feels odd that I always bring up her story, but somehow I'm compelled to. It explains the child I was, the woman I became. I want to tell you the story of a young girl who at 22 years old weighed 59 pounds, barely the weight of her bones, I said to a seminar at Harvard about girls' health. The reason she weighed 59 pounds is that she had just spent 13 months in the Nazi death camps of Auschwitz and Ravensbrück. It was a true miracle that that young girl didn't die, though she came very close. When she was liberated and returned to her family in Belgium, her mother fed her like a little bird, every 15 minutes, a tiny bit of food, and then a tiny bit more, making her feel as if she was being slowly blown up like a balloon. Within a few months, her weight was close to normal. There are always murmurs in the audience when I get to that point in my mother's story, perhaps because it is so shocking and unexpected, or maybe because I am living history to a young audience that has heard only vaguely about Auschwitz. It must be hard to imagine the high-energy, healthy woman speaking to them having a mother who weighed 59 pounds. Whatever it is, I want and need to honor my mother, her courage and her strength. It is what made me the woman she wanted me to be.
We've just heard The Woman I Wanted to Be by Diane von Furstenberg. Dick Cavett is back, sharing his reflections and reminiscences about Hollywood legends, American cultural icons, and the absurdities of everyday life. In brief encounters, conversations, magic moments, and assorted hijinks, the legendary talk show host who narrates introduces us to the fascinating characters who've crossed his path. Listeners tag along as Cavett spends an afternoon with Stan Laurel at his modest apartment in Los Angeles, spars with Muhammad Ali at his training camp, and comes to know a young Steve Jobs, who woos him to be Apple's first celebrity pitch man. Cavett also offers commentary on contemporary politics, the indignities of travel, the nature of comedy writing, and the utter improbability of being alive at all. Jimmy Fallon has called him a legend and an inspiration, and has written a foreword that makes clear the debt that today's talk show hosts owe Dick Cavett.
I'm bowled almost over by how many readers replied so intelligently and revealingly on this subject, the mystery of dreams and dreaming. I asked a learned friend about this, Dr. J. Meltzer, the legendary physician to whom I went for medicine until he retired, and to whom I still go for his culinary gifts and for education and tutoring on tough subjects. He said that this whole area, the workings of the brain, is the next great frontier of discovery. following upon such achieved milestones as the genome, molecular biology, Darwin and evolution, etc. Anyway, some not fully grasping the subject might add to the milestone list the microchip, video games, and Viagra. Dr. Meltzer talked about the super miraculous validation of the fact that the myriad separate circuits of the brain talk to one another, and without our being in on the conversation, besides, probably just as well that we can't hear what they say about us. Now, this plays into my question last time, to which so many readers responded about how a dream can be, so to speak, written and produced and played before us without our being in on its creation. If we're just the viewer, who is the dream's author? Meltzer tied in with this the fascinating distinction between the thing that makes us human creatures unique, consciousness, and simple awareness. A dog is not conscious, he's aware, but only we are conscious. You're tempted to say some are more conscious than others, but let that pass. Hearing an intellectual starker like Meltzer talk about such stuff makes me want to go back to school. He's greatly interesting about how we all have two brains, the rational brain and the irrational brain. Not to get sidetracked from dreams here, but for an oversimplified example, the rational brain knows not to smoke. Philosophy's heavy hitters have also addressed this subject, calling attention to the nature of dreaming and its kinship with madness. I've been haunted since college by Baudelaire's, wasn't it Baudelaire? I have felt the wind of the wing of madness pass over me. Insanity and dreams share many things, among them disordered thought and, of course, hallucination. As Artie Schopenhauer, so I'm a name dropper, had it, a dream is a short-lasting psychosis, and a psychosis is a long-lasting dream. Could Soupy Sales have put it better? Does anything show the complexity of the miraculous brain more than that weird curiosity, the sleep protection dream? In Freud's native tongue, probably something like Schlafschutztraum.
That was a sampling of Brief Encounters by Dick Cavett. Readers, biographies can be so riveting, don't you think? For more bios and titles across the spectrum, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.